This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 144. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today you are joined by thousands and thousands of photographers from all around the world and all different skill levels sitting down now to get our weekly dose of photography knowledge. To talk about today's topics, we have Darren Meller, Nick Page, and Jeff Harmon. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Well, howdy. I would say the biggest news that's happening right now and is impacting probably everybody listening to this podcast is the new Lightroom has come out. Lightroom has had a series of updates in the last several months, and each one seems to be worse than the next. Jeff, I know that's kind of your main topic today. What's your take on it?
Yep. So this week was Adobe Max. It's one of their big conferences where they get together and talk about all of their Adobe products and all the cool things that they're doing with them. And it seems super clear that what's happened here is the marketers said, you have to release on Monday morning of Adobe Max an update to Lightroom Photoshop. It has to go out. I don't care where you're at. That's what has to happen. And that's exactly what they did. They didn't care where they were at. They pushed out whatever it was. And it's really bad. Totally unusable. I haven't had nearly as much trouble with Lightroom as you have, Jim. And I think, Nick, you've had some pretty good trouble with it. It's worked well for me on my system, my Windows 7 machine. But as I tried to install Lightroom 6.2 is the version, the standalone version that's that was just released, or Creative Cloud 2015.2 is the version for Creative Cloud. It is unusable. Well, for most. I have heard some feedback that for some people it's working, but for almost everybody, it's really struggling. It's bad enough. People have been searching like crazy. How do I roll back? Because that's not trivial either. So let's talk about what's there.
Can we do a raise of hands here? Nick and Darren, have you guys tried it as well?
No, I saw everybody having issues with it. And the last update was so bad that it left me regretting it. So I'm like, I'm going to be very slow to updating. So no, I didn't update this time.
And how about you, Darren?
I ran for the hills and I just have an ear out waiting for the all clear.
All right. That's probably smart because I'm in Jeff's camp. I tried it because I always get it as soon as it's released because I want to be able to talk about it. And it's quite bad. As soon as I installed it, no problems. I used Lightroom for a few minutes and everything was fine. And I thought, what's everybody worried about? And then I came back to do a project about an hour later and the whole right panel was just completely grayed out and nothing I did would ungray out that panel. Just I could not make any edits to any photo at all, no matter what I did. I bet it's crashed four times today in the hour and a half that I was using it. It's really bad.
And I was just poking around at it, trying to see what's different so I could write an article about it on improvedphotography.com. And as I did that, it crashed within 2 minutes of my installing it. It had crashed. So there's lots of crashing going on. It doesn't seem to even matter what OS. So for me, I was trying on El Capitan. I know I've said not to install that yet, but I'm trying it out. We're testing the waters for you all. And so I had it on there. So I was worried, well, maybe it's because of El Capitan for Mac OS. But as I've gone out and researched it, it's every operating system. It's Windows 10. It's Windows 7. It's Yosemite. It's El Capitan. Everyone is having crashing problems. There's very few that are not, and it's probably just because they haven't had enough time to truly go out and try doing things in if you're not having crashing problems. Mm-hmm. Another thing that's been, so let's talk about the things that were changed, the things that they tried to do. Obviously, they didn't try to build into crashing, at least I hope not. But they changed the import.
Ah! Why did they change the import?
They changed
why?
It.
Why?
Yeah, you know, they've added a couple of things here and there to import over time, and they've been positives. They added the ability to put it in a collection, for example. They've added some stuff over time, but this time they revamped the whole thing, and the best description I have for it is Fisher Price. Oh, it is Fisher Price now. They're trying to make it so that a two-year-old can try to go and figure out how to import things. But as a result, you can't do anything advanced. You can't.
Okay, I'm with you. Oh, this is you're getting me upset here, Jim.
It is brutal. So there's a bunch of features that you can sort of find again, but they're hidden behind a gear wheel, and you have to work for it to find some of them. But there are some that are just plain gone. One of the key ones that I'm seeing written about a lot is the move feature. So when you're importing photos and you used to have across the top, it had like add, copy, move, and move is gone. You can't move. And there's some people who are saying,
I didn't notice that.
They're saying that is a big part of their workflow. Yeah. There's some that even have it in presets. Uh-huh. So that when they're importing, as they apply presets to things, it moves it to different folders. That's totally broken and gone. So they're really getting flamed out. Or Adobe is just getting creamed this week. So there's a forum online called the Photoshop Family Feedback page or something. And they it's the place people go to give them praise, which there's not much there, to express a concern, offer some suggested features, and to describe problems. And I go through and read those constantly so that I can see what other people are dealing with, see how big a problem it is that maybe something I found, see what solutions, because there's Adobe engineers that are monitoring that forum too, and they go and offer solutions about ways you can try to fix different problems. So normally when there's a thread of someone who's expressed that they've got a problem, you might get 20 or 30 people who say, oh yeah, I got that problem too. Or I'm same thing. You might get 20 or 30. And that's about that's a big problem if it got that high. Just this week, within 2 days, I didn't check today, but within 2 days of release, this thread on this release jumped up to 150 people saying this is junk. Wow. So it's just blowing up. It's really a problem. There's also a couple of other people that watch Lightroom very, very closely who have written articles about how they are saying for the first time ever for any kind of Lightroom release, don't install it. Mm-hmm. That's been their advice. It's just bad.
Yeah, well, in addition to the crashing, I want to go back to the import dialogue. I hadn't noticed that they got rid of the move feature. That's crazy. I use that. Not every time, but I do use that. That's crazy that that's gone. But coming from the perspective of somebody who has taught Lightroom to thousands and thousands of people, the biggest problem that we get on the import dialogue is not where the photos are coming from. We read left to right, right? So the first thing you see on the dialogue on the left on the old pane is import. And so people automatically intuitively understand where to import from. Nobody asked for a tutorial on that. In the middle, you see the photos that are selected, are checked. Those are the ones coming in. If it's grayed out, it's not coming. People intuitively understand that. The problem with the import dialog has always been the right panel. The panel where it says where your photos are actually going to live on the computer. That's always been confusing for non-techie people that don't understand that your photo isn't actually in Lightroom. It's just in any old random folder on your computer, and Lightroom's just referencing it, right? That's been the sticking point forever. That's the one that everybody is confused with. And yet, what Adobe has done is taken the part that was already obvious and intuitive, where the photo's coming from, and made it its own Fisher-Price looking design, like you said. That was already intuitive. And then they took the part that's been confusing people for years, and they hid it under a little gear wheel in the settings that makes it much harder to understand where the photo is actually going. There is no way that this import dialog makes any sense. It's slower. It's two stage where design and computer programs is all about removing steps, about doing everything in one page. So we're going the wrong way in terms of design. We're going way the wrong way in terms of actually fixing a problem that users are having. I don't know where this came from. It's got to go, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, if the photographers have anything to say about it, it will, because they are really killing out Adobe on that specific thing. The other feature that they added, which would be like the driving feature, I think, in why you would want to upgrade, and it seems really silly to me, is dehaze in a brush or filter. And I kind of liked the dehaze thing initially. I haven't really used it since like the first week it was released. There just hasn't been that big a need for it. It does help in astrophotography. I liked it there. I don't do a whole ton of that. So it's a rarely used feature to me. The fact that they added it into a brush or filter, it's worth it to me to skip this release because it's so buggy to not have that feature. So I guess I'm glad there's not some killer feature that went along with this, because I'd really want to run it if it was. And this isn't a killer feature to me.
I actually like the dehaze slider. I've been using it quite a bit more. In fact, I have an article coming out on improvephotography.com just next week called 5 Unconventional Uses for the Lightroom Dehaze Tool. And as I was doing research for that article, boy, I found some pretty cool places to use the dehaze tool where nothing else really works. And so I'm actually pretty happy with that. There's no way I would trade that tool for all the bugginess and the crazy import dialogue, but I think it's cool.
What's crazy to me is, like, you know, the biggest selling point forever has been that if you do the Creative Cloud thing, you're going to get all the latest updates and all the wonderful things that Adobe is going to come out with. And now here we are, like, reminiscing about the old days back when we had Lightroom 5 and it actually worked properly. And here we are, we have Creative Cloud, and we're like, whatever you do, don't upgrade, because, you know, Lightroom's going to completely, you know, fall apart. It's not helping the Creative Cloud structure. You know, it's not helping the trust issue. I know that I'm not going to update until all of this is sorted out, because Lightroom is working slow enough for me already.
It is really slow.
For somebody like me, because I literally, like, on a day that I get to edit, which is like only 5 days a week or so, I probably spend 7 hours in Lightroom every day. And I can't afford for that 7 hours to need to be, you know, 9 hours, because I have to be restarting all the time or something. So this is just scary to me.
I think that's a good point, though, that I've been stressing at improvephotography.com and in our Facebook group about, it's not worth it. I know there's this huge desire. I have a huge desire myself to go and install whatever's the latest and greatest. I can't not push the button. It's really hard not to do that. But if you're a photographer, how can you possibly spend time on speed bumps like this? It's going to really slow down your business if there's a problem. It's going to be you don't want to have to spend 3 or 4 hours in a day just trying to figure out how you can get back to where you were so that you can be productive again because some release was not good.
Yeah,
exactly. I think that's important to kind of take our, you know, listen a little bit here on this. I know there've been tons of people have given feedback like, hey, it's been fine for me. You guys are just you're crying wolf here. But the problem is that it's not fine for lots of people. And why take the risk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And the other thing that I think is maybe kind of the backstory of this is when Adobe announced the Creative Cloud, everybody's response was, well, okay, but now I'm locked in paying for updates, whether or not you make anything cool that I want to pay for, right? And I've got to think that the engineers took that kind of personally, like, no, there's no way we're leaving this. We're going to make this great software. We're going to keep releasing features. And so I wonder if part of this is them trying to prove that, no, look, we're pushing ahead. We're making all kinds of new features. And it's just gone way overboard. We just need some stability and speed. Mm-hmm. Hello, speed. We need some speed more than anything.
Right. I really thought that the next update would be like fixing the previous update. You know, like, why can't we have an update that actually fixes all the problems that we've already got? Let's calmed down with all the crazy new features and new looks and stuff. And let's just like make the original version like work. You know, that's what I would like, is just one that works nice. And I don't really need a dehaze brush. Well, maybe it would be cool to like paint in some fog or something.
If everything else was working.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, okay, real briefly, and then we can move on from this topic. Let's talk about rollback, since I'm sure there's lots of people who are very used to just saying, oh yeah, go update. And you may have been stuck now with the new version and it's not working. So it's unfortunately not a trivial process. It's not super easy. You can't just go into the Creative Cloud app and say, hey, I want the rollback to the one before. That's something they should add.
Yeah.
But instead, what you have to do is you have to uninstall Lightroom first. And when you do that, it asks you if you want to also remove your preferences. And I think you should try not removing your preferences first. Don't check that checkbox when you uninstall. And you hopefully will end up kind of where you were at through the end of this process. Now, if when you go and reinstall and things seem just really messed up again, then you might want to do another uninstall, and this time just remove your preferences, and then you'll get a nice, fresh, clean install, and hopefully it'll be a little better. Then the steps after you uninstall are to go and download version 6. Or you can even go back to version 5 or version 4. Adobe has those available for download so that you can use your Creative Cloud subscription to run any of those versions. Mm. But when you install those versions, you're going to get the initial release version of the software. So if you pick 6, you're going to get version 6.0 or CC2015.0, the initial release of 6. Same with 5 and same with 4. So then, after you download and install the base version, then you also have to download and install the patch that takes you up to 6.1.1 or CC2015.1.1, which is the release just before this really terrible one. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of choose where you want to go with that. And for links to those things, you can go to my article out on improvephotography.com. It's the article that talks about Lightroom being rejected. And there's links in there. There's a link to a page that has the links, I should say.
Great. Very good.
Yeah, I think that the guy who I was photographing pictures in Aspen, Colorado, probably got an early release on Lightroom, because he came out furious at me because I was shooting in the middle of the lake. And that's really what my topic's about, is to figure out whether or not we should actually be submerging ourselves in water to possibly get the shot.
And so what do you think?
Well, my thought is do it. I mean, we had Majid on the show and he talked about getting in the middle of a stream to get the shot. And I lined myself up in the center of the lake and got a beautiful shot I otherwise wouldn't have got from the shore. But, you know, I'd like to see what you guys would do if someone approached you and said, hey, you need to be considerate of the people who are along the shore.
So my question would be, how many photographers were up there? Like, how many photographers were lined up on the shore?
Conservatively 300, maybe.
Yeah. That's a lot of angry people. That's all.
Only
I can think of.
Wait,
so there are 300 people on the shore in a, yeah, you know, in a line, because that, and you waited out in front of them?
No, I just walked out in the middle of the lake. Went out in front of the water. Yeah.
You didn't wade out in the water. You walked out in the water?
Yeah, I just stomped through the cold water and got completely soaked, almost drowned an iPhone, and just stood out there and got the shot.
I don't know. I think I might be a little bit annoyed too, honestly.
I could picture myself throwing things out at the photographer in the water. I don't know. It depends on how long you were out there. Like, if it was,
I would say 2 minutes tops, because we did a bracket shot, okay, and left.
It wasn't, was it during sunset? Like during the peak of the light happening or anything like that?
I could bend the truth, but it was pretty close to golden hour. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Yeah. I could picture myself getting fairly upset at that. I mean, if you're working around that many people, you kind of have to be at least a little bit courteous. Like, nobody wants to be the one guy to like make that many people upset, because for one thing, that's just not safe. You don't know if there's any psychos in that line. Like, some of those people might be packing. So I don't know. I think that might have been, I probably wouldn't have done that.
So would any of you guys brave that or not? Am I the only one who would march into cold water
I would march into cold water. I don't know if I would march in front of 300 photographers. Right, exactly. So I totally get your sentiment, Darren, that like sometimes people kind of feel like they own the mountain or they own the national park or whatever. And they're like, hey, you're in my shot. And it's like, this is where I want to stand, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you might have to scoot forward, you know? But it's kind of like with anything, you know, there are just certain customs and things that we do. You know, when you go to the bank, you don't just walk in front of everybody else in line. You got to wait for your turn, right?
Right.
So there are certain customs in different places. You know, if you're both just out there and you were in a spot and then somebody comes up behind you and wants to move, I'm going to say, sorry. No, I was here and this is where I want to shoot from. But I don't know, where there are 300 people shooting and then stepping out in front. I don't know, that I don't know, that might kind of feel like it's breaking a custom to me personally.
Right. It kind of it reminds me of I was doing this photo shoot at this kind of iconic place here in the Columbia River Gorge, where there's this old rusty car surrounded by a bunch of wildflowers and stuff. And every spring, it's a really popular place for photographers to go. Well, I went there this spring and I got there before dawn thinking, oh, I beat the crowd. And there was like, I don't know, five other photographers there with me. And one of the guys had just gotten the new 11-24. And he was shooting at 11 millimeters, like 2 feet from the car. And he was in like every single composition for like 20 minutes while the best light happened. And I remember being so upset with him while I was cloning him out in all of my photos. So it depends. Like, if you want to go in there, quickly get your shot and then bounce back out, that's totally understandable. If you're in a situation where there's 300 photographers, just imagine how long it would take for everybody to jump in and grab that shot. Like, that would pretty much take up the entire sunset, people jumping out and taking the photo. So it kind of depends on how many photos there are. And as long as everybody's like working together to get the shot, you know, we're all on the same team here. Kind of, you just kind of have to consider some of those things, I guess.
Yeah, I think it also depends who you're with as well. Like when we're with the Improved Photography Travel Group and we go somewhere, and you know, sometimes it's 70, 80, 100 people in the group, and you know, you're going to step in front of everybody. I don't think that's a problem. You know, we all know each other. We're all kind of on the same team, like you were saying, Nick. And so I'll do that all the time. And I know others on the group will do, you know, we're all kind of in a line shooting the same shot over and over. And I'll say, or somebody else will say, hey, I'm going to just jump up there real quick and snap one because I wanted a little bit of closer perspective. Run up there, snap your shot and get out and tell everybody I'm just going to be a second, you know? So I think that's a little bit different because, you know, you kind of know the people that are there. But I feel that frustration sometimes when I'm in Grand Teton National Park on Mormon Row, where they have those really famous barns that you shoot in front of the Tetons. Like, there'll just kind of be this line of photographers, and I don't know who it is that always starts the line so far back from the barn. But sometimes it's just killing me that, you know, I just want to scoot up like a lot, you know, and shoot. But, you know, it's a big line of guys and you can't. I don't know. It's just kind of a tough thing. So I think if you want to do something like that, you just got to get there early and be the first one. But I don't know, if people are there, it's a tough thing. It really is. It's tough to balance when that's okay and when not. But definitely, I think if you are going to do this, it's got to be in and out quick, and you got to tell everybody what you're doing.
Yep. Yeah. And if you got one guy shooting time lapse, he's going to be the one that's really mad at you. He's going to be the mad one.
It's a good subject, Darren. Thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I barely escaped with my life, so I'm happy we talked about this.
I'm glad you're alive, man. Well, before we go on, we have other topics we want to talk about today. We want to thank Squarespace for supporting Improved Photography. They've been a great supporter of the show and making everything that we do possible. Squarespace is the best way to make your photography portfolio, your website, the way to sell your prints online. It's just an excellent solution for photographers. You can also set up a custom photography blog, make it look how you want. They have lots of different designs, and blog about photography, talk about photography, do whatever it is you're going to do. The reasons that I like Squarespace is because it has a really low barrier to entry. I mean, $8 a month is their starting plan. And it'll do what photographers need. It's really very powerful software. I run my own websites for improvephotography.com. I was a web designer in a former life, but when it comes to my photography portfolio, I just use Squarespace. It's easy, it's powerful, and it does what I need to, and it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg to get there. And if you do run into any problems, which frankly is kind of unlikely because it's really simple to use, you can call or you can contact Squarespace's customer support staff 24/7, and they are just really helpful and knowledgeable. So I'd encourage you to go check out Squarespace at squarespace.com. And when you do, remember to use offer code IMPROVE at checkout, and that'll give you 10% off your first order. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Improve Photography. If you haven't checked them out, I really would encourage you to at least go look at their trial. Go take a look at the designs that they have. They're absolutely gorgeous. I'm using it on my website. Jeff, you're using it on your, or excuse me, Nick, you're using it on your website. Mm-hmm. Darren, I know you are as well. And we're using it because we like it. I was using it before they were even advertising on the podcast. So thank you, Squarespace. And remember, squarespace.com, and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout. Squarespace built it beautiful. All right, let's go ahead and go to the next couple segments. I want to talk about photographing people with tattoos, which I know is a little bit of a weird subject, but it's actually pretty interesting. And then, Nick, I know you're going to talk a little bit about portraiture as well. Okay, so I know this is kind of a random topic, especially for me, because you're never, ever going to catch me in a tattoo parlor. But do people say parlor anymore? Was that just not cool? Did I just say something not cool?
That sounded so dated.
Dang. See, I'm not even cool enough to say tattoo. I just can't even do that. But I want to talk about the copyright when you're taking pictures of people with tats. See, that was cool, right?
Oh, that was very
good. So the issue is this. You're the photographer and you want copyright over the photos you take. Well, that's easy. All you got to do is click the shutter button and you've got your copyright. Well, what happens when you're taking a picture of other art? And in this case, that's exactly what you're doing. So let's say I totally lose my mind, midlife crisis, go to the tattoo parlor and get a beautiful, beautiful butterfly tattooed on my face, right? Well, the artist who has designed that tattoo, made that drawing, has copyright over the beautiful, beautiful butterfly on my nose. And then Nick comes by and he takes a picture of me. And yeah, he has copyright over the photo. And I can give him a release of me, of my likeness. But what about that tattoo artist who drew the beautiful, beautiful butterfly? What are his rights? And as it turns out, it's not as obvious as you'd think. I was turned on to this subject on the Reddit, our photography subreddit, and some users were talking about this. And somebody asked, you know, can I use photos of people with tattoos? And universally, everybody commented and just said, oh, yeah, it's fine. That's just an urban myth. And I said, not really. As a lawyer, that is not an urban myth. It's a huge issue, and it's totally unsettled in the law right now. There is no precedent to rely on. Some kind of similar sort of cases have wandered through, but we just don't have any direct answer to that question of what you can and can't do as a photographer. So I have an article coming up on improvephotography.com with more about this. But there are two cases that kind of give us our best info about this. One is about the movie The Hangover. Never seen it. Not cool enough. But the movie The Hangover Part 2. So on that movie, they had somebody, I think it was Andy Bernard from The Office. I have seen that. That's hilarious. So Andy Bernard from The Office has a tattoo on his face, right? Well, the makers of the movie got that tattoo design from the tattoo on Mike Tyson's face. Why would you get a tattoo on your face? Seriously. They took the design from Mike Tyson. And so when the designer of the tattoo on Mike Tyson's face saw the movie, he said, hey, you stole my design. And so he sued. And The problem is the case settled out of court. And so we don't really know what the judge would have said. We do know when there was an injunction hearing that Chief Judge Perry said that the plaintiff's case was strong and likely to prevail on the merits. But then they settled out of court, and so there's no precedent. We don't really know where photographers stand. Then there's another case. This one is Rasheed Wallace, the NBA player. Nike does a commercial with Rasheed Wallace that they show him talking about his tattoos and how cool he is, whatever. And then the designer of his tattoo then sues Nike and says that that they have appropriated his design without paying him. And the only difference there is this time they kind of animated the tattoo. So they're kind of creating a derivative work. But that's much closer to the photographer's situation of I just took a picture of somebody with a tattoo because here it's not somebody who took the tattoo design and put it on somebody else's face. Here it's just I took a picture of somebody with a tattoo. And problem is case settled out of court. And so photographers are just completely in the air right now as to where the law stands on this issue. Your guess is really as good as mine. So I want to give you a couple best practices if you're photographing somebody with a tattoo. One, don't freak out about this. Yes, go take a picture of somebody with a tattoo. This is so unlikely to become an issue that it never has, ever. Like, this is never, we have no binding precedent. Only twice could I find lawsuits on this issue. But if you're photographing a famous person or a celebrity with a tattoo, be afraid. Be very afraid. Because wherever famous people walk, lawsuits follow. And I would definitely be concerned about taking a photograph of a celebrity with a tattoo and then selling that photo. Somebody's going to get hit, right? Because this hasn't gone through court yet, and eventually it's going to. You don't want to be caught in the crosswind. Next, don't publish photos that feature a tattoo as a central feature of the photo. The issue here is whether it's an incidental part of the image. It's just somebody that happened to have a tattoo, and where you're really focusing on the tattoo, that's the main story. Gets a lot dicier in that situation. Don't take the design of the tattoo and put it somewhere else. You know, a married couple has tattoo hearts of each other on their shoulders, and you take those tattoo designs and put it on the wedding album. Not smart, my friend, not smart. And then watch out for tattoos that feature an obvious infringement of somebody else's rights. If you take a picture of somebody that has a tattoo of the Nike swoosh, it's not going to be good, because now you have the tattoo artist coming after you. And Nike coming out at you. So be careful. And then the last thing is, don't sell photos of people that have tattoos for stock images, because then you don't know where that photo is going to end up. It could end up on a billboard. It could end up on packaging of a product. It could end up anywhere when you sell it on stock. And that means it's a high likelihood of the tattoo artist seeing it and having a problem with it. So don't be paranoid about this. This probably sounds scarier than it is. It's not a huge issue for photographers because it's not being litigated a lot right now. But it is a caution area. And so if you fall in those kind of special situations, at least know this is an issue and you need to tread lightly, possibly even getting the permission of the tattoo artist. Anybody have a take on this? Ever shot somebody with tattoos? What do you kind of think?
I've photographed people with tattoos, but I've never shot them. I don't really have a take on it because I don't sell that kind of thing as art. You normally, like, I know Annalise, she has a couple tattoo artist friends where she goes in and photographs their art for them. So obviously she's not going to get sued for like actually working for the tattoo artist. But yeah, I've photographed them, but never for art.
Cool. All right, Nick, you have a little topic you want to talk about, bracketing photos. Let's hear it.
Yeah, completely different subject.
All right, and now something completely different.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to. I'm not sure how to segue into my segment, so I'll just go. How many of you guys shoot bracketed shots, like ever?
I do.
I do. Rarely, but sometimes.
Okay. So I shoot bracketed shots like in a lot of situations where you wouldn't really think that you would need to. I do it all the time in real estate. Like every single real estate photo I take, I bracket my shots. And that's for obvious reasons. When you're taking interiors, the windows are super bright and the shadows are super dark. So great scenario for that. When I take landscape photos, and if it's a sunset type situation where the sky is bright, the foreground is dark, I take bracketed shots. More and more, I'm taking bracketed shots during my portrait shoots. I've mentioned this a couple times on the Portrait Session podcast, where I will set my camera up to take a two-shot bracket, where instead of taking three shots where it takes a medium, a dark, and then a bright, it just takes the normal exposure, and then I can set it to take either a darker exposure after or a brighter exposure after. So an obvious case situation for that would be if I'm, you know, I've got my couple out and there's this beautiful sunset happening, and if I expose for their skin, the sky is going to be blown out, and if I expose for the sky, they're just going to be shadows, and I can bring that back in post, but it's going to be noisy and kind of low quality because, you know, it's not going to look good if I have to boost up the shadows that much. So what I do is I set my camera to take a two-shot bracket. That way, my first exposure, I'm exposing for the skin. And in the second exposure, I'm exposing for that beautiful sky that's happening. And what I'll do is I'll take those two exposures into first Lightroom and then Photoshop. I'll align them and then I'll blend in the sky using either luminosity masks or some of my sky replacement stuff. So I shoot bracketed shots all the time in different situations. And so I wanted to kind of talk about like when are good times to bracket. Anytime that the dynamic range is so much that your shadows are going to be low quality. Most of the time when we think of shooting bracketed shots, we think that, like, you know, the sky is going to be super bright and the shadows are just gone. And that's not always true. You can bring up those shadows, but by the time you bring them up, like by boosting your shadows, they're going to be really low quality. They're going to be kind of grainy. They're not going to be as high a quality as if you would have just exposed the photo longer. So even if the dynamic range isn't super, super crazy, I will still shoot bracketed shots. That way I have really high quality shadows and I won't have any blown out highlights. Anytime that you have a fairly high dynamic range situation, that's a great time to bracket. A lot of times when people think HDR, they think the Photomatics cartoony looking grungy HDR, and it can be a cool thing sometimes, but you don't always have to use Photomatics. Now Lightroom does it. I think the other day we were talking about our workflows for like HDR panoramas, and there's a program called PT GUI. You can throw all your bracketed shots and all your panorama shots, just dump them all into the program, tell it to go, and it'll just sort it all out, and you can still do exposure fusion and stuff like that within the program. So, or you can use luminosity masks in Photoshop, which is a really advanced but really powerful tool. And that's how a lot of the really amazing epic landscape photographers get their really natural looking results, is by using luminosity masks in Lightroom. And you can really come away with a lot of natural looking dramatic shots where you have this crazy dynamic range, but somehow you squish it all together in a natural looking way. So I just wanted to rant about bracketing shots and how it's a good thing, and how it's not only for landscapes and real estate. You can also find a use for it in portraits as well. So
when you take a bracketed photo in a portrait, mm-hmm. are you then masking out the HDR effect on the people, or are you just doing a really light HDR effect so that it doesn't affect the skin?
Well, so what I'm doing is I'm not actually running it through any kind of HDR function. I take the two shots, I will adjust them separately, then I will move them over and open them as layers in Photoshop. I will align them, and then I will essentially, just using layers, paint in my sky.
I see. Okay.
Masking, right?
Right, exactly. Using layer masks. And so there's times that it's much easier. Like obviously if it's windy and I've got trees, that's going to be a nightmare. but yeah. I had that one photo that was kind of making the rounds there for a while that everybody liked. It was that wedding photo with the old red truck, and
that was cool. That was
awesome.
And that's all that was. It was two shots. I took one for the foreground and then a darker one for the sky because we had that nice sky happening. And luckily there was no movement in between shots, and I could just align them and paint in my sky from the darker exposure.
So going back to expose for the skin,
mm-hmm.
describe that, like what metering mode you're in and how it is that you're making sure you're exposing for the skin instead of the entire scene.
So I don't use metering like at all, really. I use my eyeballs. So I take a photo, I look at the back of the camera, I'm like, oh, that's too dark. And then I take another picture okay. and I'm like, oh, that's so good. Ah, man, I'm amazing. So when I say expose for the skin, generally, like if you're taking a portrait outside and you expose for the skin, the sky is going to be blown out because, yeah. you know, by the time you get it nice and bright and happy and the shadows are not all, you know, blocked up, the sky is just gone. So I'll get that set in first. And then with setting up that second bracketed shot, I will just set that to either two or even three stops darker. That way I know that I'm capturing all the highlights in that sky. And that way, if I need to, I can still brighten up that sky a little bit and even it out and then layer it all together and do my voodoo in Photoshop. And it ends up coming away with a more natural looking photo, because if I was to take those two photos and run it through Photomatics, there would be some really terrible things yeah. happen to those not people. Good. Like, I don't know if you've ever ran a portrait through HDR or Photomatics or something, but what comes out on the other end is not a portrait. It's hamburger. So
hamburger.
It's terrible. So, I think that it's a much more natural result if you just layer them in together in Photoshop. So that's my tips and stuff.
So the way I try to do the expose for skin, I'm not as good as you. I can't just eye it. I guess I don't have enough experience with it. So I use spot metering. In fact, I almost always use spot metering because there's usually a point in the scene, whether it's portrait or landscape, that I want to meter for. Mm-hmm. And so I'll do spot metering. I'll put the center spots, usually where the spot metering is happening. I'll put that over the place where I want to meter from and make sure that that's the place I'm going to expose to. And then I'll use that to set in my exposure. And then I'll ignore, once I recompose, what the light meter says from that point on.
Right. Yeah. And that works. But for me, it feels like that slows me down. Because I go into it knowing what I want the photo to look like. Like I want it to be bright and happy. And I feel like the brighter a photo is, the more cheery it looks. I would say, like, if I was actually looking at my meter, and even if there was no bright sky in the scene, I would say that I'm generally overexposing all of my portraits by at least a stop, just because I want the skin to be nice and bright. And another thing you find about bright portraits is it really reduces the blemishes. Like, you don't notice the blemishes in a photo where the skin is really bright, because it's so bright that it loses some of its texture. And a lot of times that's a good thing, because the texture in skin is generally like pimples and warts and moles and like all the
warts and moles and lions and tigers.
That's what it usually is. Usually it's a wart.
At least where I live it is. So skin cancer, melanoma, you know, things you want to just overexpose anyways.
But the comments stuff.
I do have to say, as I continue to practice, I'm getting closer to where, you know, I take a guess on the settings before I get mm-hmm. going, and I'm getting so that I'm not too far off when I do this metering. And sometimes the metering doesn't help because it's off too. The camera's it's doing the best it can, but it's not perfect. And so it's getting closer, but it's someday I would like to be able to just, by looking at something, say, okay, I know exactly where I should be on this.
Right. And generally, like, you walk into a situation and you can at least guess your ISO. Because, you know, if it's daytime and you're in the shade, it's like probably ISO 400. And then you can get your aperture where you want it. And then you do the rest with shutter speed, you know. So if you know two-thirds of your exposure triangle, you can dial it in really fast, because you can change shutter speed like super crazy fast. Anyways, that's my rant. I probably went over my five minutes.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right, and now for the doodads of the week for the week of October 8, 2015. And I will start this time. So we always have new listeners to the podcast, and so I am sorry to bring one back that I know we've talked about many times, but I got some comments on improvephotography.com that made it seem like maybe we haven't been talking about this enough recently. And so I'm going to recommend the Humble YN564 version 4 flash, the YN560 version 4 flash. It's a cheap, inexpensive $70 flash that I think all or most of us, at least on the show, are using for our primary or sole flash. I have owned at least a dozen of these, maybe not quite two dozen, but almost. I love them. It's a $70 flash that, in my opinion, is in a lot of ways superior to the $600 Canon and Nikon flashes. If you shoot the Fuji system, which I have switched to, then this is a much superior flash to the brand name flash that Fuji makes. Fuji doesn't actually even produce their own flashes. They really just take a Sunpak flash and just bolt their name on it. But the YN560 is my doodad of the week. If you don't have flash, you haven't played with off-camera flash at all, go to improvephotography.com and look at the recommended gear section, and I have exactly what you need to trigger your camera off camera and a flash photography basic series that will walk you through in 10 pages everything you need to know to get started with flash. It's all free at improvephotography.com. Jeff, what do you got?
I have LocSac waterproof pouches. And it's not necessarily for your DSLR or bigger cameras. This is for your phone. And so I've ruined a few phones in my day, taking them in places that where there was water, or had stuff spill on them. I had my son put it into a backpack, and then sunscreen spilled in the backpack and ruined it. So if you're going to go out on some adventure, you're going to go outdoors, taking your phone with you and going to get some photos, you can drop it in one of these waterproof pouches. You could try a normal Gladlock sandwich bag kind of thing too. I've had good success with those. The problem is they come apart too easily, and it doesn't really the screen doesn't work very well through them. It's really kind of hard to do it. These, I like it because there's a very good zipper there, and it works. The screen works flawlessly through them. So they're see-through. You can still get to your phone. You can still use the screen. You can get a 3-pack for $20.
Very cool. Darren?
All right. Mine is an iPad or a Kindle of any type, like just a tablet. Power it off. You're not going to be using it for anything besides using as a cool surface for detailed shots. I've seen another photographer do wedding ring shots, and I've also been messing around taking pictures of cool things like old Matchbox or Hot Wheel cars that I owned as a kid, but it creates a really cool reflective background.
Cool. Good idea. Nick?
Mine is the Platypod camera mount. I just got mine yesterday, and essentially it's just this little plate where you can mount your tripod ball head, and you can set it right down on the ground, or like right now I have it on my table or on my desk, and it completely supports my 5D Mark III with a fairly large lens on it. It would be a great thing to have, like if you're going to a cathedral or something and you're unable to take a tripod in, you could just put this little thing right down on the floor and take long exposure photos, or you could take it out landscape shooting and put it right down on the ground. It's a really cool, cheap little thing. It's the Platypod camera mount.
Very cool. Well, thank you everybody for listening to us here on the Improved Photography Podcast this week. And we will see you in another 7 days.